The following recording is for Marie Johnson with the American Hospital Association of Washington for Saturday, March 21st, 2020 at 9 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you'd like to ask a question. I would now like to turn today's conference over to Rick Pollack. Mr. Pollack, please begin.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to join this call regarding the situation on the ground in hospitals and health systems across the country and the urgent need for federal aid to ensure that frontline medical personnel have the tools and resources they need to effectively respond to the coronavirus challenge. Joining me today are Tom Nichols, the AHA's Executive Vice President for Government Relations and Public Policy, and Nancy Foster, the Association's Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety. We're also joined by the leaders of three hospitals who will speak about their experiences from the front lines. But first, let me give you a little context in terms of what we're facing. We're clearly still in the early stages of this crisis, and the lack of testing and timely results has made it hard to know exactly what is coming at us. Ensuring safe care for patients, protecting healthcare workers, and supporting the health and safety of our communities is what we are all about, and it requires every part of the healthcare sector to work together, from those on the front lines to federal, state, and local government. Equipped with the right tools, guidance, and resources, we will do our very best to protect lives and keep people healthy. Here's what we do know. We know that no part of the country is untouched. We know we simply could not manage this crisis without the hardworking and dedicated physicians, nurses, and other frontline staff who care for patients and maintain our facilities and equipment. We also know that hospitals and health systems across the country are intensely focused on ramping up in terms of having the supplies and surge capacity to treat all the patients who present with symptoms of COVID-19. And we know that the financial pressures on hospitals caused by cutting elective procedures and staffing at higher levels than ever before could mean that hospitals, many hospitals, won't survive the financial strain. We're already seeing facilities facing shortages of needed equipment and high expenses in providing critical care, and this hurts our country's ability to respond. That's why on Thursday, the AHA joined with the American Medical Association and the American Nurses Association to call on Congress to provide $100 billion in direct funding to support medical personnel, supplies, and infrastructure. Specifically, we're calling on Congress to create an emergency fund for expenses related to COVID-19. We also badly need child care support for frontline healthcare professionals so more can stay on the job. And we need funding to increase surge capacity and create alternative sites of care. Now, I know that's going to sound like a lot of money, but it's what's needed to adequately respond to this once-in-a-century event. The reality is that we are in a war in which hospitals and health systems are on the front lines and our healthcare workers are putting their lives on the line to fight this battle. And I know you've heard a lot of cliches and analogies, but no one ever sends their troops into battle without the right protection, ammunition, and tools. You know, half of a hospital's budget ordinarily involves supporting workers, our healthcare heroes. These are the people who provide the help and hope we need when we're most vulnerable. These are the people who make sure that when you walk through the door, you will get the best available care. These are the people who prepare the meals, clean the facilities, and make sure our medical equipment is working. These are the people who have faced disasters before, hurricanes, wildfires, mass shootings, and more. They know what to do. And that's why it's important that they're able to focus on what matters, and that's providing care to patients. One last thing, a quick word about the federal government's response so far. The AHA is working closely with the federal government to ensure that we have the support we need. I really want to commend CMS in particular for clearing regulatory barriers and cutting through red tape to allow us to take quick and decisive action so we can operate more effectively during these unprecedented conditions. And we're also pleased that the administration has declared this pandemic a national emergency, and we urge that the Defense Production Act be fully employed to ramp up production of personal protective equipment in order to keep our frontline responders, our heroes, safe on the job. We're hoping that those platforms will allow American ingenuity and innovation to be applied to meet this challenge, just as our parents and grandparents, those that were part of the greatest generation, rose to meet enormous challenges in the past. So we stay focused on this. Now, we got another concern. Having enough tests and getting the test results back as quickly as possible so we can have a more accurate picture of the infection rate, because without the tests, we are simply burning up PPE at unsustainable rates. That's because we find ourselves taking care of people in hospitals with maximum precautions who are symptomatic but may in fact be negative. And if we had the tests and we got the results quickly, we can free up PPE and hospital beds for those that really need the care. We remain concerned about being able to handle surge capacity as the virus spreads, and we remain seriously concerned about whether hospitals will stay afloat to weather the storm given the financial challenges involved in meeting payroll and having the staff, equipment, and supplies. With us today are three hospital leaders who will share their perspectives on what this looks like on the ground, in their communities, from the front lines, and they'll provide real-world examples as to why we're calling on the federal government to invest in America's hospitals and health systems at this critical juncture. First, I'd like to introduce J. Scott Graham, the CEO of Three Rivers and North Valley Hospital in Brewster, Washington, Washington State, one of the hardest hit states. Scott, take it away.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Our community is in a very rural part of the state of Washington, about 4 hours from Seattle, which is the epicenter of the disaster here. We have not seen the surge in our part of the country, but what we are doing is continuing to prepare for what we assume will be a massive increase in patient volume. So we're preparing on two tracks. Our first track is that preparation and being ready. The second track, however, is one in which we're trying to figure out how to stay in business. Because of the mandates for social distancing, the cancellation of elective surgeries that went out from the governor a couple of days ago, we have seen our patients avoid the hospital. There are no patients coming in. Volumes are low across all services in the hospital, and as a result, all of the revenue that typically comes in that we need to cover the costs of operating has dried up. Our cash on hand continues to erode. We are now in a negative cash position and are using credit. We will exhaust all avenues to make payroll in the next 3 to 4 weeks. We have requested assistance from local officials in our county. They have been unable to respond. We have sent urgent requests to our state leaders, and they are frenetically working right now to try to get us some assistance. We were able to get $150,000 that will be available this coming Monday, and we're grateful for that. They are trying to get more, but frankly, that gives us about an extra week and a half of payroll. If we don't get some assistance in the next 2 weeks, we will have to begin to have the conversation with our doctors and nurses and other staff and our communities that we will no longer be able to be in business and that we will have to close the hospital and then have to dispose of the assets of the hospital and transfer patients to other places. We are contacting our local bank to see if they can extend our credit limit. Again, they're struggling with their own issues and have not given us any kind of a commitment. We have stopped paying all of our vendors and are concentrating on making sure we can meet payroll. Our PPE is on back order. We can't get it, so we have mobilized our community to start making PPE for us. We are scouring the hardware stores and the farm supply stores for farm equipment that orchard workers use. when they do spraying of the fields to use that as PPE. We cannot get cleaning supplies. They're on back order, and we're going to need all of those things to keep our workers safe should there be an increase. We, in terms of our planning, from a disaster perspective, we know we need to ramp up, but at the same time, we're concerned that we will not be able to be around because of the financial hit that we've taken by the time that the patients, the surge hits us. We are, again, working with our local officials. We're working with partner hospitals who are in the larger urban areas to see if they can send their less critical patients to us as they are hit harder. Again, logistical barriers are getting in the way of that. So those are some real-life realities for us in that we're at a time when we need to be increasing capacity for hospitals. Our hospital may not be in business by the time that that's needed.
Thanks very much, Scott. And by the way, in Washington State, they stopped elective surgeries by an action of the governor. Here in Washington, D.C., CMS has put out guidelines as to how to handle that matter, and we support the guidelines that they put out. So moving from Washington State, which is one of the hardest hit states, let's go to New York City, which is also experiencing some very serious problems. And I want to welcome Larae Brown, the president and CEO of One Brooklyn Health System, also, again, one of the hardest hit areas. Larae?
Thank you. So our system of 3 hospitals, 3 nursing homes, and 11 community health clinics serves a community of approximately 2 million people. We have been a safety net hospital system, and in fact, prior to this public health crisis, we were relying upon more than $20 million a month of support from New York State. New York State recognizing that they had to keep these hospitals open, and therefore were given that level of support. Our community is mostly people who are insured through government insurance programs, 80%, 70% Medicaid, 10 to 20% Medicare, many uninsured individuals. So we were already in a financial crisis before this public health crisis set on us. We are considered an essential health care provider because we also provide a significant amount of the behavioral health or psychiatric and substance abuse services in New York City. We are facing a critical cash crisis. As my colleague just said, I like to say that our cash is on fumes. We have less than 2 weeks cash on hand, again, before COVID-19. We are now looking at an additional cost of $30 to $34 million a month from the projection of staff increases, not only staff to cover the surge increase of capacity that I'll talk about in a minute, but just to replace staff or backfill staff who are going out on furlough or self-isolating or having to care for their children. New York City mayor last Sunday closed the schools. We are looking at a 20 to 25% increase in supply costs, not only in terms of the usage, but price increases. We're looking at cash disruption. It was just mentioned that elective surgeries have been canceled in New York State and New York City through governor's orders and mayoral orders. Elective surgeries, elective procedures have been canceled. But that also includes things like non-emergent dental procedures. We are a significant provider of dental services in this high-need community. We have one-time costs. We're putting up tents. We're having to buy or lease the tents and all the equipment related to that to do screening and pre-testing and triage. We're looking at additional costs related to a mandate by the state health commissioner that we put in plans to increase our existing bed capacity by 50%. And that will include not only staff costs, but equipment costs. ventilators, beds, other supplies, monitors, et cetera. So, as I said, having been facing financial crisis, it has now gotten to be more of an existential crisis. Just last night, our CFO said, how are we going to pay people? We're spending more money is going out than coming in. But our reality is we have to respond to the needs of our patients, to the needs of our community, and to the needs of our city and our state. I would also say that, you know, there are many, many health systems in New York, some of them being more well off than safety net systems such as mine. And those systems are projecting negative positions when at the beginning of the year they were talking about revenue over expenses. And now they're saying that they either will not have excess revenue or they will have losses. Well, we could never talk about revenues over expenses. We cannot borrow any money at this juncture. So we don't have anyone to cover our expenses. I would add to what my colleague said, our cash situation is such that we are going to be having to make critical decisions in terms of the continued provision of services to the Brooklyn and to specifically Central Brooklyn, which is an extremely high need area. Thank you.
Thanks, Lorraine, for giving us that picture of what you're facing. Finally, I want to introduce Kevin Donovan, who's the president and CEO of LRG Healthcare in New Hampshire. Take it away, Kevin.
Thanks, Rick, and thank you, everyone, for taking the time today. Our message and our story seems very similar to Scott and Lorraine's story. We're larger than Scott's organization, but much smaller than Lorraine's organization. We are a two-hospital system in central New Hampshire. We serve about 87,000 people. We are the primary healthcare service provider for all 87,000 of those people. We have the two hospitals. We have about 20 affiliated medical practices or ambulatory care centers and ASCs, ambulatory surgery centers in the region. So effectively, we are the healthcare provider for the Central New Hampshire Lakes region. We currently have about 70% or more of our payers, which are either government payers or self-insured or no insurance, meaning that we are reliant upon the elective work that comes from much of the commercially insured population, which, as my colleagues have noted, we have put a complete freeze on. So we are no longer performing any non-urgent, non-emergent, or elective services. Those include outpatient physician practices and all types of procedures and surgeries. And so when we are normally a $210 million organization, we project that these changes in the loss of elective services is probably about an annualized reduction of about $50 million. And as we are starting to see other volumes decrease, it's probably greater than $50 million annualized. Prior to this crisis, much like my colleagues, we were in extremely poor financial condition. We have a handful of days cash on hand. We hover around 4 to 5. When it's a payroll week, we drop below that. We have no debt capacity, so there's no ability for us to go to our local banks who we talk to, and we've talked to them recently again. So our debt-to-equity percentages are in the 80% range or greater. So we can't borrow any more money to get through this. Like other organizations, we've also started to see our expenses increase. So we've set up triage tents in all of our emergency room parking lots. We have started to begin to see what I'll use the term price gouging from some vendors. We have started to see an increase in credit holds from vendors. So we are unable to pay our bills, and they're telling us they will not ship us necessary supplies until we pay them cash on hand, cash on delivery. We are unable to do that, and so we are having vendors who are effectively telling us they will not ship PPE or they will not ship other necessary medical supplies to us that we need to take care of our patients at this time of crisis. Our fear is that this will only get worse as the COVID-19 pandemic increases. We currently have had a number of positives in our community. I can tell you that we have greater than 10 patients currently in our hospitals who we are treating as they are positive for COVID-19 because we have been unable to get testing back on them. Testing, as Rick referenced, is extremely limited right now, and I have every expectation that COVID-19 is widespread in our communities. And the only reason that we don't have the numbers is because we're only testing healthcare workers and we're only testing those folks who are hospitalized and that we're trying to rule out if they're COVID-19 patients. I'm very concerned about this because as I think about the community we serve, you know, we again are the primary healthcare provider in the state of New Hampshire. We currently have about 2,300 beds approximately. We've done some modeling at the statewide level that if there is a simultaneous 2.75% infection rate in our state, that we will need 9,000 hospital beds. And so recognizing the fact that we're already about 6,000 short from or more from what we need in this state, the state cannot afford to lose 137-bed and a 35-bed hospital that employs all the medical staff within the central region of New Hampshire. We have been very fortunate to date that we have been working collaboratively with our state government. Our governor has been trying to his best to respond to this crisis. As a relatively small state, though, we have limited resources. As a state without an income tax and without large reserves, we have limited resources to help our hospitals. And so we are relying and hoping that the federal government and Congress will come to our aid. And like my peers, if Congress does not act swiftly, we expect that we will likely not meet payroll in a number of weeks. That will cause us to make some serious decisions. And again, the last thing we need is the loss of hospital providers and healthcare providers at probably the most critical time in the last 100 years in this country.
Thank you, Scott, Larray, and Kevin, for sharing your experiences. And I think these stories are reflective of the experiences of thousands of hospitals across the country. And again, that's why the legislation being considered on the Hill right now is so important in terms of providing needed support. Let's open it up to your questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Also, before each question, please announce your name and affiliation. Again, that is star 1 for any questions. We'll pause briefly for any questions. We'll take our first question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Tammy Luby from CNN. Thank you for holding this call. Could you explain a little bit more about how the cancellation of elective procedures is affecting you in terms of, you know, you're dependent on it because they tend to be more commercially based coverage, which pay you more? Can you just connect some of the dots there for us?
And I'll ask my colleagues to weigh in on that, but also keep in mind that we throw around the term elective surgery, and I think you heard from them. Elective sometimes is life-saving, sometimes it deals with cancer surgeries and with heart valve replacements, so elective isn't just unimportant types of things that aren't immediate. But I think, Larray, you were going to get in there?
Yeah, I was going to say, and thank you for that, Rick, because I was going to make that distinction. Elective surgeries or elective procedures can range from things as critical, but as breast surgery, as cardiac surgery, as endoscopic procedures, but as I mentioned, dental procedures. And for some people, many people, a dental procedure is incredibly important for their health. But to your point, as to your question about the connecting the dots, those are the types of procedures that pay a greater amount and because they use a greater amount of resources. And so if we cancel, in my system, if we're canceling 20% of the elective procedures, we're looking at losing $8 to $9 million a month. And even if we see increases in people walking in to the emergency room, and who have symptoms or believe they have symptoms, the reimbursement for that emergency room visit or that screening visit is far less than for an elective, either surgical or another invasive procedure.
Did Scott or Kevin want to quickly weigh in there?
Sure.
Could you let us know roughly what the commercial rate is, or how much you're depending on the commercial rate, and how much more it is than
essentially
government,
is it not
an issue commercial versus Medicare?
I want to deal with the commercial issue. It is not in our case in Brooklyn. We don't have a significant commercial payer base. So as I mentioned, 80% of our patients are government insured, Medicaid or Medicare, and another 10% are uninsured. So we have a very small commercial base to begin with. So it's not about whether it's commercial or not. It's about the rate of reimbursement for different types of procedures as compared to outpatient visits. And that's the driving force and to our concern.
Rick, this is Kevin. Are you okay if I jump in on this?
Yes, please.
Sure. So I totally agree with Lorraine. And there are two types of cost shift in the United States. One is the type of cost shift that she's talking about how procedural services, they support, the reimbursement for those support things like primary care and basic inpatient admissions. Then the second type of the cost shift is where commercially insured patients pay better than government payers, and they thereby support the government patients. And so our issue here is both. So what we're seeing is much of the elective work, I'll use an example, but screening colonoscopy for someone who's 50 years old, who's commercially insured, is one of the services that pays well for us and allows us to take care of the 82-year-old with congestive heart failure who's in the ICU and on Medicare. And so as we look at the 50-year-olds with colonoscopies no longer coming in, and we see more of the 82-year-olds with congestive heart failure being put into the ICU, it raises a question of, without the cost shift, how do we basically keep the lights on?
Thanks for connecting those dots. Why don't we go to the next caller?
Thank you. We will take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
This is Amy Goldstein from the Washington Post, and thank you for doing this call. My question isn't about the cash on hand and the loss of elective procedures revenue, but with respect to supplies and the price gouging that you're starting to see, or the inability of vendors to work with you under these, you know, financially stressed times. I'm wondering what any of you are hearing from either the Trump administration or your state health departments, which may have been in touch with the Trump administration, about when you can start to receive PPE or anything else that you need from government sources if you haven't been already.
This is Scott from Washington State. We haven't received anything definitive. As far as the price gouging in our area, we haven't seen that yet, but we also have everything on back order because we just can't get it in. Vendors are struggling to meet the need that's out there, so we know what our inventory is, and we know what we need to bring in, and we just can't get it in. We know that patients have heard that testing is available, and so they come to our hospitals expecting to get tests. And in our hospital at North Valley, near the Canadian border, we have 30 tests for the entire community there. At Brewster Hospital in Brewster, Washington, with Three Rivers, rather, we have 80 tests on hand. And so we're saving those for the most critical, our healthcare workers and so forth. But we have no timeline or understanding of when those tests are actually going to arrive in our community.
Does Larray or Kevin want to weigh in?
Yeah, I'd like to. In terms of PPE, we are literally putting in weekly requests to New York State and New York City that have stockpiles, which are diminishing. And so both our mayor and our governor have beseeched the federal government to generate the greater production of the PPE and distribution to the state so that they can supply the hospitals and other healthcare providers with what's needed. Our system depends on what the PPE is, but as an example, in terms of N95, the mask, respirator mask, we have a couple of weeks of those on hand. And we were have been told by the state health commissioner that we, to make sure we let them know, and they are monitoring, frankly, every day across the healthcare system in the state, the amount of PPE that the providers have available. There was a question about price gouging, and I would just give an example that's not related to PPE, but it's related to people. Many hospitals, including ours, and use what's called agencies to provide our nurses, and particularly nurses in areas in hard to recruit clinical areas, such as OR nurses or critical care nurses. We've been apprised by those agencies that they're going to be increasing their rates anywhere from 15% to 16-20%. I wouldn't be calling it price gouging, but what I would say is that it is another drain on our already very fragile financial position and for a critically needed service. We need those nurses, and we will pay. And I hope that those increases that those agencies are charging are going to go to those nurses for hazard pay. But we are not, we're not in control of that. But that's just another example of the cost of critical supply, human supply, as well as supplies of equipment and PPE are increasing.
And Amy, what we understand is that our members, if they need to access the strategic stockpile, they have to go to their state. And it's the state has to make the request on their behalf. And to the point that Larray made, it's well and good to go to the stockpile, but that's where the Defense Production Act comes in. That's where we really have to ramp up the production of the masks, of the gowns, of the gloves. I think Kevin or Scott was telling me earlier, I think it was Scott, that in his community, and the media has done a great job of covering some of these stories, we have people that are making masks at home and donating them to the hospital, and then the hospital sterilizes them. We've got to use that Defense Production Act and literally have the National Guard come in and get supplies from textile manufacturers. Gloves, gowns, and goggles are something that we should be able to turn around in this country with aggressive actions. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, that is star one for any questions, and please announce your name and affiliation. We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is David. I'm from Politico. My question is about the amount of money that you're asking from Congress for. The Federation for American Hospitals called for $225 billion. Are you guys sticking to your $100 billion number? And if so, what's the state of negotiations on the Hill?
Tom, I think that one's for you.
Sure. Yeah, I'll take that one. As Rick mentioned, we work with the American Medical Association, American Nurse Association, to have a unified front of doctors, nurses, and hospitals to request help from the federal government. And we've also worked with some of our allies on the Hill on this, and we came up with a number of $100 billion, and we sent that up to the Hill earlier in the week. That is what we're requesting. That is what I think many on the Hill are actually looking at and looking at very seriously. If somebody wants to give us more than that or somebody wants to provide additional dollars, that would be fine. but I think the $100 billion, again, the united front of us, the docs and the nurses, is what we're asking for right now.
Mm-hmm. Can you say that's what looks more likely? Do you have any commitments from leadership for that $100 billion at this point, as it's being written into text today?
Well, I know that they're working toward it, and again, as you know, negotiations are ongoing. They went late last night, and they started up about an hour ago, and we're hoping that they get to that number.
Thanks for that question. Next question.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Bob from Harvard. Just wondering, with this, if federal funds are allocated, how will the American Hospital Association make sure that hospitals like the three that are on this call are the ones getting this money? More or less, you know, how will funds be allocated?
Tom,
hey,
Tom, you want to
Tom,
do that?
It's Tom, yeah, it's Tom again. We've given a series or a menu of ideas to the Hill that they could look at to provide the dollars for our members. Some of it is for personal protective equipment. Some of it is for a fund that hospitals could go to get additional help, like the folks who are on the phone today. Some of it is for changes in payment policy, which would actually be good because it would get the money quickly to our members. I mean, changes in Medicare, et cetera, would be, you know, CMS knows how to process claims. If we do additions to payments, that would be another way to do it. For example, we've talked about getting rid of the sequester in Medicare. That would be 2% more for every DRG payment that hospitals get. We've talked about periodic interim payments so hospitals can get the dollars more quickly. So we are pitching a lot of different issues, working with the Hill, and I think they're, I don't think that I know it, they're taking it pretty seriously.
Thank you. Want to go to the next question?
We'll move on to our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi there. This is Rachel Kors from Modern Healthcare, and I did just want to kind of focus on the timeline here, because what we're seeing out of the Senate GOP proposal, you know, it looks like this emergency fund isn't included. We do have a suspension of the sequester and some add-on payments, but it looks like a lot of this that you're asking for, there's a potential that it could be delayed toward, you know, a phase four package or something like that. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to the timeline and the urgency of kind of when this funding might be allocated.
Yeah, Tom, I guess you'll handle that, but I'll just say, you know, this stuff, this is very urgent. We need to get this done now, and I don't know that we can wait for a fourth package. I mean, you've heard the urgency here, and knowing how disruptive life is to everybody these days, and as you know, they're trying to figure out how to even process votes under these circumstances when you're not supposed to have more than 10 people gathering together in any place. So I think we need to make sure that this package includes as much as possible. Tom?
Yeah, I know you're referring to the document that Leader McConnell put out, I believe it was Thursday night. And even he said, and others have said, that was just the first step. I think that document is not relevant right now because it's been massaged, improved, negotiations between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. So there were a couple provisions in there. You're right, there's sequester relief. There was also an add-on for DRGs for COVID-19 patients. Those are both good provisions, but clearly we need more, and I think those conversations continue, and I believe there will be more.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll move on to
our next question.
We'll move on to our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Peter Sullivan with The Hill. I was just wondering if you could talk more about the Defense Production Act. I mean, basically, the funding for you doesn't really help you get PPE and so forth because it's all sold out. Is that basically right? And so you need the government to basically increase the production capacity of PPE and ventilators and that sort of thing?
Precisely. I mean, we need more supply. We need to produce more product. And that's where the Defense Production Act comes in, and if aggressively employed, it has the potential, not like what we've seen in other crises in some of our lifetimes, that could be a very useful vehicle, but it has to be executed on. And I guess it wasn't in our lifetime, if we're referring to World War II. That's my reference to us being the children and grandchildren of what went on back then, as an example
right.
that people often, you know, refer to.
But basically, if you have a hospital that just tries to order PPE through normal channels, it's basically all sold out right now?
I'll defer to our colleagues from the field on that one. I think you heard people expressing that. That is largely the case. And even if they had it, they don't have the ability to purchase it because they don't have the money to purchase it because they're demanding cash on delivery. But let's
yeah.
go back to Scott LeRae and Kevin.
Sure. So, Rick, this is Kevin. I'll take that one. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly correct. There's no PPE, essentially no PPE to be bought on the private market from vendors. So if we get any, it's through requests to the state or to the federal government. And so, you know, we order things and we're told, okay, yeah, the delivery date will be April 10th. We know that come April 10th, we won't need that. And then to your point, Rick, that, you know, we're struggling to pay for it when it gets here because we're on credit hold and they say, okay, how are you going to pay us? And by April 10th, we won't have any money to pay it. So it's just, you know, unless we start to get all the resources from the strategic national stockpile, I don't know where they're going to come from.
This is Scott from Washington State. I would concur with what Kevin said completely. And the irony is that if they wait until April to get this figured out, we won't be here to assist. Our doors will be closed.
This is LeRae Brown, and I would agree with my colleagues, but I also would like to add that PPE is critical. However, other types of equipment are critical. If we are being asked, in the case of New York State, to increase our bed capacity by 50% of more to bring on more beds than we have, we literally need to buy the beds. And so, to my colleague's point, if we don't have the immediate cash relief, then we cannot buy the other types of equipment for which there may not be as critical of a shortage, but they are needed as well.
And again, that just points to why the legislation on the Hill needs to happen real quickly, and those resources need to move out as people are trying to surge capacity. And whether it's tents or opening up old floors or bringing recommissioning facilities that may be closed, or working to get empty dormitories, or working to get hotels in a place where they can provide medical care, that's why we need that kind of support in addition to the PPE for sure. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, please announce your name and affiliation before each question. We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hello, this is Lauren Clayson with BQ. Thanks for doing the call. Rick, you mentioned that you supported DC's elective procedure guidelines, so I was just wondering if you could kind of talk about what those are and why you guys support them. And then also, have you considered asking lawmakers to do something on elective procedures, since that would help with revenue if there were appropriate guidelines put in place, either that or dealing with the price gouging with vendors or what Lorraine was talking about, the credit hold?
Well, certainly, you know, in terms of dealing with any of the price gouging issues, those are real issues that need to be dealt with. In terms of elective procedures, we're not asking Congress to do anything because CMS already took an action. And again, I just can't stress enough how, you know, these decisions on so-called, and I say so-called, elective procedures need to be made at the local community level. And you see they've been made at the local community level and several of the people that are on this line. And the fact of the matter is that we see people beginning to stop them all over the country, but it's nuanced. Again, if you have to, sometimes if a procedure is considered elective, just because it's scheduled, but a scheduled procedure to replace a heart valve or a scheduled procedure to deal with a tumor from a cancer perspective is not exactly unimportant. I mean, these are life-saving procedures. And to their credit, CMS put out guidelines on how to tier these things, where there are certain types of things that, as you heard from our colleague in New Hampshire, you know, just simply don't need to be done right now under these circumstances, and CMS acknowledges that. And then there are others that are kind of in a gray zone, which is, hey, maybe you shouldn't do these unless it's absolutely necessary. And then there's yet another tier that says, hey, these things really are life-saving, and we recognize that those things probably need to go on to the extent that they can go on. So we think CMS already took a responsible action on how to address this whole issue. But again, I can't stress enough how the word elective is it's so much more nuanced, as you can see, than just saying stop it or start it, you know? Next question.
Thank you. We will take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Robert Chang with Fierce Healthcare. I wanted to talk a little bit about the payroll issue. Can hospitals, like the ones on the call that are struggling to meet payroll, be able to use the fund that you are proposing Congress to approve, that $100 billion?
I think that's probably more of a Tom question, Yeah.
Let me start and see if anybody wants to chime in. Yes. I mean, how much of the $100 billion goes toward that fund is part of the negotiation that's going on right now. But the short answer is yes.
How much are you wanting it to go towards it then? Since this seems like a pressing issue for, like, every single hospital that you had on this call said that they aren't going to be able to meet payroll in a couple of weeks.
There are different ways to provide assistance to the members, and what we've worked out with, what we're working on with the Hill is going back and forth in terms of how much for which portion. Adding money to DRGs is another way to do it. Periodic payments is another way to do it. The fund is a way to do it. PPE is a way to do it. So we haven't gotten to the point where I don't think in the negotiations where we're talking about what percentage goes for what, but that is, as they say, an ongoing conversation.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi there, it's Hannah Kushler from the Financial Times. I wanted to hear a little bit more about the shortages you're experiencing, and in particular, are you starting to see any shortages in drugs?
Why don't we go to Scott Murray and Kevin on that one?
We are not seeing any shortages in drugs. However, what I would say, I think as one of my colleagues mentioned, that given our financial situation and our having vendors out 90 days out, 120 days out in terms of our having been able to pay them, we are experiencing the drug distributors from again, requiring that we have cash on delivery or refusing to accept our invoices because we've not paid them.
This is Scott from Washington State. The surge hasn't hit us yet, and so we have not seen the shortage yet in pharmaceuticals. We still have our supplies, but we're anticipating that and trying to prepare for that should the surge come, and assuming we'll still be in business at that point.
And this is Kevin from New Hampshire, and we're in the same boat that Scott and Larray are. And as I talk to my colleagues across the country, I have not heard tremendous outcry about the lack of availability of pharmaceuticals and drugs, and I think part of that is because the patient population that we're talking about here for COVID-19 is a population that, when treated, is not placing a tremendous new demand on pharmaceuticals and drugs. Now, there clearly is a demand or need to get vaccines and new drugs that can treat those patients, but at least on existing stores, that's not been my experience.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Samantha Liss with Healthcare Guys. In terms of capacity and preparing for a surge, we're hearing how hospitals are trying to use alternate facilities to boost their ability to meet demand. But what I'm hearing today, and I'm wondering if you can provide a little bit more color, it seems that these dire financial strains that you're in are preventing you from really having those conversations or making concrete plans for backup facilities. I'm wondering if you can provide more information on that. And are you all expected to pay for extra beds, to pay for backup facilities, or is that something that local government or federal government will help you with?
So this is Lorraine. In spite of our existing financial challenges, we are planning to increase capacity for surge because that is what we must do. And as an example, all hospitals in New York State were just asked yesterday by the state health commissioner to submit plans for the creation of 50% more of their existing bed capacity. And so we are making those plans. We are identifying what the staff needs are for those surge beds. We are looking at alternative spaces to create additional intensive care capacity. We are identifying the additional equipment needs, ventilators, which are in shortage, but we are identifying how many additional ventilators we need in order to create that additional capacity. It is our anticipation that we will get some support from the state. However, New York State is in itself challenged because of all of the increases in costs related to responding to COVID, and frankly, because of decreased tax revenues related to COVID. So this is why I'm on this call and my colleagues are on this call, because we need immediate cash relief from the federal government in order to help us sustain our operations and to respond by increasing our operations for the needs of our community.
This is Scott from Washington State. In this lull that we're in while we're waiting for the surge and our volumes have dropped off, we're hoping to be the extra bed capacity for the other hospitals that are larger and have higher patient volume. But as we look at ramping up, we understand that, you know, the limits have been taken off of the 25-bed limit for our critical access hospitals, and we can actually get more room and more beds. That will be on us financially as far as we understand it. We'll have to provide those extra beds and that extra room. But more critically, we were already in a nursing shortage and a physician shortage prior to the crisis, and finding the additional staff will be, I think, the biggest challenge, and then protecting those staff. So we will need a tremendous amount of support financially in order to be able to do that in the way that will protect our communities and protect our healthcare workers.
Okay, next question.
Thank you, and we will take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Susan Morse from Hims Media. I'm wondering about getting the money and drilling down on how it will be allocated. It sounds like hospitals need almost a direct deposit of some of these funds to pay operational costs. And I'm just wondering if you can say again, how will this work to get the money to you quickly enough to help you pay the cost that you need to pay?
Hey, this is Tom again. Again, we've got a number of options to do that. Again, this fund that we've suggested, Kate, that hospitals could go directly to and get money from, that would be one way to do it. Again, additional payments that kick in right away. I know the Hill is looking at, you know, additional payments for COVID cases. It could be an add-on. It could be periodic payments. There are a number of ways to do it. clearly, whenever you're dealing with the government paying out for services, speed is important. And we've given them, as I mentioned, a menu of ideas. I think all of them would work. I think they ought to do all of them.
And Tom, would this be money that would go to the states and then go to the hospitals, or would it go directly to hospitals themselves? Is there a way for the funds to do that?
We would prefer the money go directly to the hospitals themselves. Nothing against states, but that takes even longer for that to happen. We've had that experience with what's called the Hospital Preparedness Program, HPP, which is a good program, and we support additional funding for that. But it takes a while for the dollars to get through. There are administrative costs associated with that. So we think there needs to be mechanisms to get the money directly to hospitals. That's why a fund would work. That's why add-on payments to Medicare, again, they know how to process claims. They pay the hospitals in 30 days, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is much better than having the money go through the states.
Okay, thank you. And if I could ask a follow-up question to that, when the president declared a national emergency, he said it would free up billions of dollars to go to states. Have hospitals seen any of that funding?
We haven't here in Washington State.
And in Brooklyn, we have not seen it. I don't believe the states have gotten it yet.
Similar here in New Hampshire. Once again, we have a governor who is sympathetic to the cause, and he's trying to come up with some solutions. But my understanding is all of those solutions from a monetary perspective have been state-based solutions. They have not been related to funds that he is getting from the federal government that then he could help us with.
As I alluded to earlier, the one thing that we did see that was very useful was the clearing of a whole series of regulatory barriers through that action that CMS has taken that's been very responsive. But that's not a resource issue per se. That's just allowing us to have the flexibility to act quickly in regard to the situation. So I think we reached the hour, and we have to really let our colleagues go back to work in serving their communities and their patients. I know that let me thank Scott and Lorraine and Kevin for being on this call. And I know we're all experiencing a level of disruption to our everyday life, not to mention hospital and health system operations that's truly unprecedented in terms of our lifetime. That being said, we're working as hard as we can to adapt to the situation, and it's absolutely critical that America's hospitals and the frontline health providers that are treating COVID-19 patients get the support they need to stay on top of this surge of patients and also to stay afloat. And I just got to say, it's worth saying again, we simply cannot manage this crisis without the hardworking and dedicated physicians, nurses, and other frontline staff who care for patients and maintain our facilities and equipment. If you have any further questions or follow-up today or as this crisis unfolds, please feel free to reach out to the AHA media team. And again, I want to thank the media for covering this event and helping share these perspectives so that the public can be better informed. I want to urge everyone to please follow the guidelines of the public health authorities and please be safe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.